Across the Pacifica network and over 50 community stations around the country, this is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, November 8, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. The UN Security Council unanimously passes the stringent US resolution to send weapons inspectors to Iraq, or else. Secret documents reveal that Britain and the US are considering the development of weapons including lasers that blind the enemy and microwave systems that cook the skin of human targets. And Tuesday's elections were a nationwide victory for the nation's lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender candidates. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Aaron Glantz with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. George Bush got unanimous approval from the UN Security Council today for his war in Iraq. From the UN, Haider Rizvi has Iraqi reaction.
There has been no immediate reaction from Baghdad on today's Security Council resolution as yet. However, talking to the Associated Press, Mohammad Al-Duri, the Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations, said Iraq will review the resolution before making any decision on the Security Council's plan. Al-Duri said he was surprised by Syria's endorsement of the resolution, but he said his government would not hold it against Syria. Syria, the only Arab nation on the Security Council, had earlier indicated that it would not accept the US and UK-sponsored resolution on Iraq. However, after voting for the resolution today, Mikhail Wehbi, the Syrian ambassador, said he hoped that the resolution will not be used to justify an attack on Iraq. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
France has also previously stated it was opposed to a resolution giving the U.S. a free hand to go to war with Iraq, but the vote was unanimous, with France's support. Nick Champeau has reaction from Paris.
3 weeks ago, French newspapers headlined, Chirac wins over Bush. Now it seems to be the other way round. The French president thought he had convinced his U.S. counterpart to agree on a two-stage process and that he had reinforced France's position on the international scene. Chirac, however, will not admit he gave in to U.S. pressure. He stated the resolution offered a great chance for Iraq to disarm in peace and that the vote reaffirmed the Security Council's role. The president has warned on dozens of occasions against any U.S. unilateral attack on Saddam Hussein's regime. However, here in France, critics say the UN resolution is a war document. Meanwhile, the French president of the socialist opposition, Jean-Marc Ayrault, said it was a trompe-l'œil victory and that Chirac gave in. Free Speech Radio News, Nick Champeau, Paris.
The Pentagon is sending 1,000 troops to Djibouti, Africa, to help the fight in what it calls the war on terror. Jason Cullum reports from Washington.
Christopher Hellman, senior analyst at the Center for Defense Information, thinks that these U.S. troop movements in the Horn of Africa could foreshadow a war in Somalia, Yemen, or Sudan, similar to the U.S. war on Afghanistan.
What you have here is the latest in a series of U.S. military missions around the world targeting pockets of perceived terrorist activity. The United States is currently looking at establishing long-term, if not permanent, presences in various regions of the world.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
A Florida county has announced it lost more than 100,000 votes on Tuesday. Sally Watt has more from St. Petersburg.
The discovery that 103,000 ballots hadn't been counted was made and corrected on Wednesday, before the vote was certified, Broward County election officials say. They add that the outcome of the races wouldn't have been affected by the error. 70,000 of the ballots were Spanish-language votes. Ironically, all of the uncounted ballots in question were early voting or absentee ballots that had been cast before Tuesday's election. Voters all over the state took advantage of relaxed absentee voting rules and cast their ballot before voting day. Many early voters said they wanted to be sure their vote was counted in the aftermath of the 2000 presidential election. Broward County election supervisors blame a computer programming error in tabulating the ballots. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sally Watt in St. Petersburg.
And finally, 9 beauty queens scheduled to participate in this year's Miss World Beauty Contest in Nigeria on December 7th have announced they will boycott the event in protest of a sentence against a Nigerian woman named Amina Lawal. An Islamic court in northern Nigeria sentenced Lawal to death by stoning for committing adultery. Samuel Okoye has more from Lagos.
The beauty queens boycotting the contest say their conscience will not permit them to participate. One of them, Mazda Joel from Denmark, has urged all contestants to join the boycott in order to put some political pressure on Nigeria. On her part, the contestant from France says when a woman faces the most agonizing death, there are more important things in life than winning a crown for being beautiful. Countries that have already indicated that they will boycott the beauty contest include France, Denmark, Belgium, Costa Rica, Spain, Switzerland, Austria, South Africa, and Kenya. The Nigerian government has in the meantime urged the countries to reconsider their stand. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
And I'm Aaron Glantz for Free Speech Radio News.
The United Nations Security Council today unanimously approved a US and British-sponsored draft resolution setting stringent conditions for renewed weapons inspections in Iraq and threatening serious consequences if Iraq fails to comply. Susan Wood reports from the United Nations.
The five permanent veto-holding members of the UN Security Council, China, France, Russia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, voted for the resolution. So did the 10 rotating members, Bulgaria, Cameroon, Colombia, Guinea, Ireland, Mauritius, Mexico, Norway, Singapore, and the only Arab Council member, Syria, which had been expected to abstain. President Bush expressed his satisfaction.
The full disarmament of weapons of mass destruction by Iraq will occur. The only question for the Iraqi regime is to decide how. The United States prefers that Iraq meet its obligations voluntarily, yet we're prepared for the alternative.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan effectively sidelined for the past 8 weeks as the permanent council members wrangled in secret over the wording of the resolution, called on Baghdad to comply with the text's demands.
Iraq now has a new opportunity to comply with all the relevant resolutions of the Security Council.
For his part, Iraqi Ambassador Mohammed al-Duri said the resolution imposed U.S. will on the rest of the world and created demands that would be hard for Iraq to meet. The resolution gives weapons inspectors of the United Nations Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission and the International Atomic Energy Agency immediate and unrestricted access to every site they wish to inspect, including Saddam Hussein's presidential compounds, which were previously off-limits. It gives them the right to take Iraqi scientists and their families out of the country for interviews, and it allows them to declare exclusion zones around sites to be inspected, in effect placing them under UN military occupation. The resolution calls on the inspectors to report immediately to the Security Council any interference by Iraq with inspection activities or any failure to comply with its disarmament obligations. Those obligations include making a full declaration within 30 days, not only of its alleged weapons of mass destruction, but also of its non-weapons facilities, such as petrochemical plants, a demand UNMOVIC Chairman Hans Blix has said will be impossible to meet. Despite the weeks-long insistence of China, France, and Russia that the resolution not include automatic triggers for military action, the outcome was never in doubt, according to James Paul, Executive Director of Global Policy Forum.
The primary issue in Iraq has to do with oil and U.S. effort to gain control of Iraqi oil resources for U.S. and U.K. companies.
Paul says this gave the U.S. enormous leverage over the other permanent Security Council members, especially Russia, whose economy is heavily dependent on oil revenues. As for the smaller countries, the U.S. has a history of cutting off aid to countries that vote against it, says Dan Plesh, a defense and security analyst with the London-based Royal United Services Institute.
If you are a small country like the tiny island nation of Mauritius, you have other fish to fry, then deciding that now is a good time to really get on the wrong side of Uncle Sam for the foreseeable future.
Iraq now has 7 days to accept or reject the resolution's terms, with the threat of war implied if it says no. If it says yes, weapons inspectors will be in Baghdad within 45 days, with an advance team due in 7 to 10 days. Iraqi Ambassador Mohammed Al-Duri said he did not know what Baghdad's reaction would be. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
If and when the U.S. decides to carry out an attack on Iraq, the southern port city of Basra will be one of the major front lines. In many ways, it already is. Basra lies within the so-called no-fly zones imposed by the U.S. and Britain, and the people live under regular U.S. bombing. The city lies between Kuwait and Iran and has been at the center of war for more than 20 years. FSRN correspondent Jeremy Scahill reports from Basra.
For hundreds of years, Basra was called the Venice of the East. Sinbad the Sailor's adventures were launched from its shores. The city is connected by a web of footbridges and canals that empty into the Shatt al-Arab, a focal point of the Arab sea trade for more than 1,300 years. It endured both Ottoman and British occupation. Fishermen and boats line the boardwalk that houses 101 towering individual bronze statues. Each one is unique and modeled after an Iraqi army soldier killed during the Iran-Iraq War. They stretch down the boardwalk for a mile, all of them with their arms raised, fingers pointing accusingly toward the Iranian border, some 6 miles to the east. The statues serve as a haunting reminder that Basra has long ceased to be thought of as anyone's Venice. Basra has been one of the most fought-over areas in the world. It's a stone's throw from both Iran and Kuwait, and suffered tremendously during both the Iran-Iraq War and the Gulf War. Basra is the heart of Iraq's oil belt, one of the richest stretches of land on earth. But its nearly 2 million residents see almost no benefit from Basra's black gold. The poor Jumeirah neighborhood is full of roads overflowing with raw sewage and garbage. The streets are packed with children playing among the trash and green pools of waste. The whole area reeks of excrement. Here lives the family of Abu Muhammad. He's worked throughout his adult life as an oil mechanic, servicing the country's vast oil industry. Yet the meager salary that he earns from his work barely allows him to feed his family of eight, including his two children with Down syndrome. Only one of the children can attend school, and the family lives in a rat-infested, decrepit hovel that can only be described as a cave. Apart from a ceiling fan and a broken TV, they have no electrical appliances. They recently sold their refrigerator and electric cooker to repair a wall that had crumbled. Abu Muhammad is a proud and dignified man. He sits on the cement floor in his home, stroking the head of Haider, his teenage son with Down syndrome, and he talks about Washington's threats to invade Iraq.
We don't accept any invaders. I belong to a tribe, and no matter what happens, I will defend them. Do the Americans think that by coming here they will have a picnic in Iraq? Even if an Iraqi has something wrong with his government and the land is invaded from abroad, he will defend it. The core of the problem is that somebody wants to take your home.
Abu Muhammad's wife interrupts.
This house is poor and destroyed, but it is very dear to us. We will defend it and we will not give it to anybody.
Across the street from the family of Abu Muhammad lives another family that survives on the outskirts of Iraq's oil industry. Majid and Karima and their four children live in a two-room shack. Majid is a struggling artist, and their home is filled with his paintings of Imam Ali, one of the holiest figures in Shiite Islam. Majid walks with a limp. During the Gulf War, he was driving in a carpool to the factory where he was working when a missile hit the road in front of them. Three of his co-workers were killed, while Majid and six others sustained injuries. He shows us his leg, left disfigured by the attack. Like almost everyone in Basra, Majid and Karima do not speak about war in the future tense. They live within the so-called no-fly zones imposed by the U.S. and Britain, allegedly to protect Shiite Muslims like them from Saddam. But Majid and Karima say they do not feel safer because of America's missiles. Like most families here, they sleep outside in a fly-infested courtyard on rotting mattresses near their outhouse. At night, they hear the thunder of Washington's planes. Majid says when they hear the roar of the planes, he feels powerless to help his wife, who says she collapses when they come.
I feel sick when I hear the planes flying above. I cry. I have psychological shock. I can't sleep. I listen to the radio and I feel scared. We are asking God just to save us.
In Washington, George W. Bush speaks of his love for the Iraqi people, saying he has no quarrel with them. But Karima and Majid wonder if Bush ever considers their children, robbed of their childhood by 12 years of war and sanctions. Across the street, Abu Mohammed says he doesn't talk to his children about what may lie ahead.
What am I supposed to tell them? That there'll be a war and you'll be dead?
All over Iraq, people speak of defending the country against an American invasion. But nowhere did this ring more true than when we spent time in the home of Abu Mohammed, his wife and their six children, in the poor Jumeirah neighborhood in the port city of Basra. For now, they continue the daily struggle to make ends meet, knowing that someday in the not-too-distant future, they may have to defend their poor, destroyed home from foreign invaders. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill in Basra.
Documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act are causing an uproar in British political circles. The documents reveal that Britain has been involved in secret talks with the US over the development of so-called non-lethal weapons that includes lasers that blind the enemy, microwave systems that cook the skin of human targets, and the use of gases similar to those recently deployed in Moscow to end the theater siege by Chechen rebels, which killed more than 100 people. The documents also detail talks about the battlefield use of the weapons and whether they can be used to back up economic sanctions against target countries. The quote assessment reports took place on November 30, 2000 and prompted demands by British opposition politicians for a full statement on Britain's involvement in developing such weapons. And as Dred Scott-Keyes reports, US and British military collaboration is nothing new, but the way in which these weapons may be used is.
At issue are what the documents say are non-lethal weapons, like so-called people zappers, or VMADs, the acronym for vehicle-mounted active denial systems, which are microwave weapons, and laser guns, which can be tunable to kill, stun, or blind. Tony Benn served in the British Parliament for 51 years as a member of the Labour Party. He says what is troubling many Britons is how these weapons may be used.
I think the significance of the discussions that are supposed to be taking place about non-lethal weapons is that there is a growing concern now what is seen as a domestic threat, not necessarily terrorism, but simply political movements that might become so influential that they threaten the policies of the Bush administration or the Blair administration. And that is, I suppose, at the heart of the reports which you've been commenting upon.
However, retired Rear Admiral Stephen Baker, a senior fellow at the Center for Defense Information, says the use of these weapons for crowd control can backfire on its users.
I think the seriousness of the possible effects of these weapons, and that would include the use of lasers, is very well up in front with the developers, both in Britain as well as the United States, knowing full well that that blinding lasers can have the exact opposite effect of what you're trying to achieve. If there's a, that would result in, for example, collateral damage that would have a public and a world outcry that would not be good for anyone.
Meanwhile, British opposition MPs believe the fact that the military is considering developing and using these type weapons in war or as a tool to threaten other countries breaches a number of international arms and humanitarian treaties. Michael Ratner is a human rights lawyer and says these type of weapons are illegal.
In 1995, a Vienna diplomatic conference passed a prohibition, a treaty, that prohibits blinding laser weapons and other basically unconventional weapons. It was probably the first major treaty to outlaw a particular type of weapon in 100 years, other than chemical and biological. So there is a protocol to the Geneva Conventions. It's called the Convention, actually, on the Prohibition or Restriction on the Use of Certain Conventional Weapons, which may be deemed to be excessively injurious or to have indiscriminate effects. It's a major convention that you can't use blinding laser weapons, and you can't use certain other unconventional weapons.
In later documents found under the Freedom of Information Act pertaining to the meetings between the British and U.S. military brass, it was noted that the term non-lethal was inaccurate. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dred Scott Key.
As the sniper suspects appeared in a Virginia court today, judges in the two counties where the sniper suspects are being tried may face a difficult task in deciding whether the trial should be moved elsewhere to seat an impartial jury, as legal experts say there is less chance of a fair trial in Virginia. Meanwhile, the Florida Supreme Court yesterday reversed the death sentence of a killer who was 17 when he brutally murdered a Florida man in 1999. The reversal comes at a time of increased intensity on executing juveniles, with one of the two alleged sniper suspects, John Lee Malvo, facing a possible execution at the age of 17. Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
In February of 1999 in Florosa, Florida, 17-year-old Ronald Bell Jr. and two younger female accomplices beat 31-year-old Cordell Richards to death. The three claimed they killed Richards in revenge for what they said were sexual advances toward one of the girls. But his death was exceptionally heinous. Richards was beaten with a baseball bat and tied to the woods, and then set on fire. He was still alive the next day when his attackers returned, so they used a meat cleaver to slash his throat. In yesterday's 4-3 ruling, the Florida Supreme Court concluded that the trial judge did not give enough consideration to Ronald Bell's age at the time of the murders. But the state attorney general's office had argued that Bell was just 2 months shy of 18 when he killed Richards, and he proved his maturity in his role as prime instigator and orchestrator of the murder. A. Bonovitz, executive director of Floridians Against the Death Penalty, said it was absurd to think that a lifetime behind bars for the now 21-year-old Bell is not sufficient enough sanction.
Anybody that believes that those people are having an easy life in there is sorely mistaken and really ought to go and visit one of Florida's maximum security prisons, because they're not pretty places. And to have to live there day in, day out for the rest of your life, especially when you've got 40 or 50 more years to your life, that's very severe punishment. And, you know, the death penalty is actually the easy way out.
The Florida Supreme Court ruling came down the same day that the Justice Department turned over sniper suspect John Lee Malvo to Fairfax County, Virginia, where the 17-year-old could face a death sentence.
I think it's despicable that there was a rush, you know, to try and execute him in a certain place. I mean, you know, there hasn't even been a trial yet or anything like that.
Patrick Mulvaney is from the Washington-based National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. He doesn't see the intensity on the sniper case galvanizing national focus on increasing executions on juveniles.
I mean, you know, Maryland doesn't execute juveniles. You know, it doesn't seem like that has, you know, generated a whole lot of fight that more juveniles should be executed. It certainly seems like the path that juvenile executions are taking is moving towards abolishing it.
A. Bonovitz from Floridians Against the Death Penalty disputes the notion that there is an appetite to execute people like Ronald Bell Jr. or John Lee Malvo. He says that appetite is mainly manifested by Attorney General John Ashcroft and other criminal prosecutors.
The vast majority of people in this country would be perfectly satisfied if we never heard from this guy again. And that's part of the problem with executions, is when you have a life sentence, that's it, it's over, goodbye, we never hear from the guy again, because there's no parole opportunities to keep coming up. But as we saw with McVeigh, as we see every time there's an execution, we have to relive the crime time and again for years until we get our vengeance. And that's really not doing anybody any good.
On Tuesday, Florida voters approved a constitutional amendment to narrow that provision in the state constitution from cruel or unusual to match the U.S. Constitution, which bars cruel and unusual punishment. The change would not affect the Bell case. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
As we reported in the headlines, election supervisors in the Florida county of Broward today said that around 103,000 votes were not counted in Florida's governor's race. While the officials say the votes only reduced Jeb Bush's victory margin by 13,000 votes, over 70% of the votes not counted were Spanish-language votes. Meanwhile, despite the Senate's fall into Republican hands, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender candidates and activists fared well in Tuesday's elections at all levels of government. From Pacifica affiliate WORT, Joanne Powers has this report.
Tuesday's elections were, for the most part, a nationwide victory for the nation's LGBT candidates and activists. Many LGBTs were elected or re-elected to office, including many running against emphatically anti-gay opponents. All three openly gay members of Congress won easy re-election to their offices, and Providence, Rhode Island surpassed Tempe, Arizona as the largest city in the nation with an openly gay mayor. Jack Johnson Jr. of Arizona was elected to the State House of Representatives, becoming the first openly gay Native American to win office in the nation. And Jarrett Barrios of Massachusetts became the first openly gay or lesbian Latino in the country to be elected to a state Senate. Bob Kearney, the political director of the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund in Washington, D.C., considers Tuesday's results to be revealing.
It's been a big year for openly gay candidates. With more than 80% of our candidates winning, we saw anti-gay attacks on gay and lesbian candidates backfiring. Even in conservative places like Oklahoma and South Carolina, we saw candidates doing very well. And in the case of Oklahoma, in fact, a gay Democrat winning nearly 60% of the vote against an incumbent while being out. And Tammy Baldwin, the first member of Congress to ever win running the first time out, won by her biggest margin ever this time, with nearly 70% of the vote. Watching candidates win in places like Oklahoma or be reelected in places like Montana and Utah say that gay and lesbian candidates have made it. They've come into their own, and they are winning in a majority of states in this country.
Tuesday saw one setback for equality of LGBT people when a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage passed in Nevada by a 2-1 margin. However, LGBT rights activists also prevailed on Tuesday in 4 referenda on municipal non-discrimination codes. While the results of Tuesday's ballots were promising for LGBT candidates, less than 1/20 of 1% of all elected officials in the country are openly gay or lesbian. New York Assembly member Deborah Glick discusses why it is important that this figure improves.
Well, I think it's critically important to have a seat at the table. Many communities, the LGBT community has no representation at all, and in most places it's underrepresented at best. So it's important to have someone with a visceral understanding of the issues who can speak out and move their colleagues to a positive point of view on issues critical to the LGBT community, and to dispel stereotypes that continue to persist. On a national level, with the government in the hands of the Republicans, who have been, as a party, from hostile to outrageously threatening to the LGBT community, it's going to be increasingly important on a state level across the country to have strong voices in state legislatures. I think we are in for some very difficult times, as are women and minorities in general.
The Victory Fund's endorsement of 43 candidates in Tuesday's elections reflects only a small portion of the openly LGBT candidates running in races across the country, from the local level to the national. The Victory Fund's Kearney fills us in on the current statistics.
There were definitely more than 100 openly gay and lesbian candidates on the ballot this year. Probably the best statistic I can give you is going into election night, there were 228 elected officials that were openly gay or lesbian or bisexual in this country. And as of right now, and we're still looking at some tallies, we look like we have 229. It looks like we'll have more openly gay and lesbian representation than we've ever had before. And those are big numbers because as recently as about 11 years ago, there were fewer than 50. The numbers are growing all the time.
Growing all the time? My first thought, oh my God, we're taking over.
Well, maybe when we get to 1% of all elected officials, maybe we can talk about that, but we've got a long way to go.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joanne Powers.
Free Speech Radio News is produced by Kata Mesta. Headlines today by Aaron Glantz. Technical producers are Jade Paget-Seekins and Pauline Bartolone. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. I'm Deepa Fernandez.